This is the sixth tape in a series by Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Well, this brings us to the third section, Under the Plot Sprung, and this is Jesus betrayed and arrested. Verse 43, and immediately while he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now he was betraying him and giving them a signal, saying, whomever I shall kiss, he's the one. Seize him and lead him away under guard. And after coming, he immediately went to him, saying, Rabbi, and kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But a certain one of those that stood by drew a sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus answered and said to them, have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as against a robber? Every day I was with you in the temple teaching. You did not seize me. But this has happened that the scriptures might be fulfilled. And they all left him and fled. Here we see the crowd then coming. It's obvious that the leaders, we're told these come from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, that is, they come from the Sanhedrin, or at least a subcommittee of some variety, that they are afraid there's going to be trouble. They've got a large crowd, hard to say what size group that might be, but probably such terms would not be used for less than about 100 people, a substantial crowd with swords and clubs. Some have guessed that the swords would be Roman soldiers that are stationed in the area, and that the clubs would be the temple police or something, who may not have been allowed to use more military type of armament. Hard to judge how that actually is. Judas presumably is guiding them in place. I mean, after all, where are they going to know where Jesus is going? How much Judas knew is hard to judge, but I think we have reason to understand it's in a parallel to our passage where it speaks of Gethsemane being a customary place where he used to go. So Judas may not know that he planned to go to Gethsemane that night, but perhaps is leading the crowd around looking for him in several places. That might explain why they're perhaps guessing an hour that they are able to finish up the feast before Judas can get these people organized to come looking. And then if they go somewhere and Judas isn't really sure where it is, he may have to look around for some more, so it takes a while for them to find a likely place. We don't know much about that one way or the other. In any case, they now come, and Judas has led them to the right place. It almost seems a little strange here that Judas uses this sign of a kiss or something. They ask, you know, what's that for? Can't he just point him out or something like that? Well, I think perhaps they did not know exactly what they were going to find in the first place, how big a group, how the group was situated, things of that variety. But Judas should be able to recognize Jesus at least with some kind of light. The other people might not. And there's a substantial chance with a crowd of 100 or so of you and with a dozen of the disciples or so intermingling and swinging at each other that Jesus might get lost in the crowd. So the arrangement is Judas is going to grab hold of him and kiss him and hold on to him until the soldiers or whoever can make sure that he's surrounded and caught and not get away. That way they don't have to worry about his slipping away in the crowd or something like that. So I guess that the kiss is perhaps intended to soothe Judas's own conscience or something, maybe, but is intended to be able to get close enough and hold on to him so that there wouldn't be any chance of his getting away. Obvious from Jesus' reaction, however, he has no intention of getting away, but of course they don't know that for sure in advance. So he comes up and kisses Jesus, and they laid hands on him and seized him. We see the attempt here by Peter, we understand, from John, to strike back. Two of the disciples have swords, not mentioned in Mark, but seen in the other Gospels. And Peter uses one of the swords, whacks one of the guys, perhaps misses partially, dodge your head or something, depends on where he was aiming, but hits the guy in the ear, cuts his ear off. Jesus, however, stops that. We learn from Luke he heals the fellow, but not mentioned here, which Mark is concentrating on the main action rather than the side action. I think the point where he actually mentions the sword in the previous situation, that's in Luke, I believe, is that from now on, you've been in a society where people have been willing to hear the message and ready to receive you and things of that variety. He says, when you went out, you didn't take any extra shoes, you didn't take any staff, you didn't take any extra cloak, you didn't take any food, and you got by all right, didn't you? And then he says, now let him who has an extra cloak sell it, to have money, buy a sword, etc. And the picture is going to be opposition now, and that they're going to have to go from place to place without people to receive them. So I think that's the basic point. I don't think his point is, you know, we're going to fight or anything of that variety. And in fact, when they say, well, here, we've got two swords, he says, that's enough. He obviously allowed them to have them. Perhaps he felt they would feel more confident having them. They certainly seem to rather panic when he won't let them use them. And when he allows himself to be arrested, they get out of there quick, my impression. I may be misreading that they panic from that, though they certainly panic from something. So that's probably the most natural thing. You get perhaps the impression that maybe Peter would have stayed there if he'd been a little whack at him with the swords until he went down or something. But Jesus stops that. And of course, with two swords, he stops it for their safety. I mean, there's a couple hundred of these guys, and if none of them got swords, they all got clubs, you're still going to get mashed to death before you kill many of them. Well, we're told that a lot of them have got swords anyway. So in the long run, it was certainly for Peter's safety that did not continue, and probably the healing in the same direction. Perhaps they'd go on looking for him if Jesus had not healed us all. Not much said about that. But in any case, Peter and the other disciples get out of there quick. Jesus rebukes the authorities when he's arrested. Notice that. Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me like against a robber? The word robber here is perhaps a rather vague word in our language. It can mean anyone who commits robbery abroad. This term is more like a bandit or a guerrilla leader, okay? It means a person who is engaged in revolution against the state and who usually robs people out in the boondocks to make money and to cause trouble and things of that variety. So, you know, you've brought this mob with clubs and swords out like you're going out to get a guerrilla leader somewhere. What did you do that for? I was around publicly in the temple. And of course, in the temple, although they were afraid to arrest him, he certainly was not preaching revolution against the government or anything of that sort. So he really rebukes them rather strongly in that direction, pointing out he was available every day in the temple. I think it's basically an indication that is, in a sense, showing them that they're not really being straightforward in what's going on. They can't build a case against him they can convince the people on, and therefore they've got to try and take him and run it all fast before a large crowd finds out what's going on. In a sense, he's rebuking them for having to do it undercover, which has some rather suspicious features legally, as we shall see. Well, we've got to keep rolling. Very short incident here, we'll call number 4, the young man flees, verses 51 and 52. And a certain young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body. And they seized him, but he left the linen sheet behind and escaped naked. Certainly a puzzling incident. Occurs only in Mark, and there aren't too many things that occur only in Mark. There have been a couple of different views suggested as to what's going on here. Some have suggested that Mark has put this incident in to show that the disciples being able to escape was really sort of a semi-miraculous thing. To Jesus having predicted that no one would be taken, no one would be killed but himself, that this in fact was a fulfillment of that, in that Jesus allowed the others to escape, but in fact the mob was of such a sort that they were even catching bystanders, and yet somehow they didn't catch the disciples. I'm a little skeptical of that particular suggestion, although I don't think it's beyond reason. I think the major problem is that if you look through Mark, he gives no hint of Jesus praying that the others escape or things of that sort. Of course, he did say they will fall away and be scattered. Well, that might be a hint. But we have nothing about his prayer that they would be delivered or anything of that sort in Mark, though I think it's still possible. There's an alternative, rather attractive speculation that has been made, but it's a speculation, and that is that the young fellow is Mark himself. And, here with Mark, and according to the speculation, which has several features in it we don't know anything about, but according to this story, since we know in Acts that Mark had a mother who had a home that the Christians used in Jerusalem later, it's guessed that the upper room was at Mark's home. We don't know that at all, but that's a guess, okay? And then it's presumed that when Judas comes with a crowd, the place he would go to first, naturally, is where Jesus was when he left. And that would be the home of the upper room. So a big mob comes, beats on the door, where is Jesus, etc. Jesus is not there, but Mark is up in bed. Here's all a racket, looks out the window, grabs a sheet, wraps it around him, and heads down the road behind the crowd to see what's going to happen. And when they finally find Jesus, he almost gets caught. He leaves the sheet behind and runs home and leaves this two-verse incident in the gospel as the only place where he actually took part. It is, as I say, a rather attractive speculation, but it is speculation. We don't know for sure several of the crucial points are right, though it perhaps gives a better explanation for why the passage is here than the alternative explanation, though it climbs out a good deal further on the limb to do so. We'll call the last heading here under Mark 14, Trial and Tribulation. Here we have the trial before the Sanhedrin, and then Peter's denial. Look, first of all, at verses 53 through 65, the trial before the Sanhedrin. And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests and elders and the scribes gathered together. Same term for the Sanhedrin. There are the three groups that make it up. Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the officers and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they were not finding any, for many were giving false testimony against him, and yet their testimony was not consistent. And some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, "We have heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands.'" And not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. And the high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, "Do you make no answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But he kept silent and made no answer. Again the high priest was questioning him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, coming with the clouds of heaven." And tearing his clothes, the high priest said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Some began to spit at him, to blindfold him, to beat him with their fists and say to him, "Prophesy." And the officers received him with slaps in the face. This trial before the Sanhedrin, if it is an official trial, is very irregular compared with the requirements for a trial that we have later in the Jewish Talmud. However, we do not know for sure whether the rules that we see in the Talmud from 200 AD and afterwards were necessarily enforced at this time. They may have been, they may not have been. It is conceivable that this is not a technical trial at this point, but it is rather a preliminary hearing to see if they can get charges that will stick before the Sanhedrin. Notice in 15:1, early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and the scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him up to Pilate. Some think that 15:1 is the official trial, held in the morning when trials are supposed to be held, and that an attempt was made to make all of this legal by doing that then. Others have suggested that the remark that the trial had to be held on two different days in the Talmud, that the leaders here made an attempt to fulfill that by having the one trial while it was night and the other trial at dawn, either being then that the one trial was perhaps before midnight and the other afterwards, making it an arrangement which would have been on two different Roman days, or one trial is before dawn and the other trial is after dawn, making it on two different days on the terms of when the sun comes up. Of course, we're not able to have it on two different days if starting day at sunset, as the Jewish calendar seems to have normally operated. It definitely, I think, gives some reason to believe that there were some irregularities here, though we can't say for sure exactly what they involved because we don't know which of the Talmudic rules were actually enforced at this time. Certainly, there have been many, many times in history, however, when a group has decided that something is a national emergency and that they will bend a few rules to do what needs to be done, even though if it weren't an emergency, they would do it in much, much more care. So perhaps we see something of that sort going on. We do need to understand that the Sanhedrin did not really thoroughly understand what they were doing in the sense they didn't know who Jesus was. They didn't really believe he was Messiah, things of that sort. On the other hand, they did know that they didn't have a good case against him, and they did know that they were bending some things to run this rather rapidly. And yet even so, they apparently made some attempt to have two witnesses who could agree. That at least would indicate to me that a minority in the Sanhedrin were making them to stick to certain types of legal procedure. Jesus had been making some strong claims. And yet apparently, because of the ambiguity, the terminology and such Jesus used, the witnesses could not come up with a plausible case. You can see that they're fiddling around with things as it stands, that their statement of what he said when he cleansed the temple in John early in his ministry is modified from what Jesus actually said. It's modified in a way to make it look like a crime that he said he was going to tear the temple down. Whereas, in fact, he only offered to build up the temple if they tore it down, which, of course, is no crime at all. So we see some things there. I think the false witnesses were trying to construct something that could pass, and yet they had a problem that unless you have worked out thousands of details between the two false witnesses before you go in, a careful job by persons in the Sanhedrin could turn up discrepancies between. Apparently they made several tries at this, couldn't succeed. That does suggest that there was somebody on the Sanhedrin doing some cross-examining that was not willing to let it be pushed by rather easily. It kind of looks like at the end that the high priest then tries to get Jesus to incriminate himself by asking him to respond to the charges. Well, Jesus had no responsibility to respond to the charges. They have responsibility to make the charges. If they make the charges, then he's got to respond. Oh, he just doesn't answer. So then the high priest puts him on oath, apparently, from the material in Matthew. It's not mentioned in Mark here. And in Jewish law, if a person is put on oath, he is forced to answer. Doesn't have to answer a specific way, but he's forced to answer. And the question is, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Now, I think that the high priest was rather clever in his selection of what to ask. I don't think the high priest considered him to be Messiah, of course, but I don't think the high priest would have considered the Messiah to be Son of the Blessed One in the sense that he understood Jesus to mean that. So what the high priest has to do, he's got to ask Jesus a question that he's pretty sure Jesus will have to answer yes, or discredit himself if he denies it. But also a question which, if Jesus does answer it yes, will be sufficiently strong to bring a vote for his condemnation in the Sanhedrin. So he picks what I would guess he has understood from Jesus' teaching. I mean, they've had spies out. They've been making notes of what Jesus has been teaching. That Jesus claims to be Messiah in a very strong sense, that he's actually Son of God in some way that the others are not. And although the Sadducees probably would not have believed anything of that sort with the Messiah, and we know the Pharisees later did not. I don't know what they believed at this time. Apparently the point is he's pretty sure Jesus will either answer that yes, condemning himself, or answer it no, thereby discrediting himself before all the people who he has been teaching to before, whom he has good enough evidence has been saying that. So I think we've got sort of a last desperate attempt by the high priest to get an answer here. If Jesus had not answered this at all, I don't know what the high priest would have done, but Edersheim suggests that in fact the putting on oath required Jesus to answer it, that he would be essentially denying the thing if he did not answer. So he does answer. He answers it very strongly, "I am," and then he quotes two passages, makes allusions to two passages in Scripture, which indicate how he understood what his answer meant. He quotes, "You will see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven," a picture in Daniel 7 of the one who has come, who is to come after the four great kingdoms of the world. He is to come and he's to rule the whole world forever, and he's to receive his kingdom directly from God. And then he quotes, "sitting at the right hand of power," which is an allusion to Psalm 110, where the Messiah is pictured as sitting at God's right hand and waiting for his enemies to be destroyed before he rules. So Jesus' response is very definite, and the result is that the high priest is able to picture this as blasphemy. And I think if that's on the basis, not on the basis of his claiming to be Messiah, that one might charge him with treason or something of that variety, but claiming to be the Son of God or the same nature of God. And so he rips his garments as a sign of blasphemy and is quite satisfied now that he's got witnesses who will stand up to cross-examination. He's got anybody he needs to use on the Sanhedrin, and all done. So whether we'd view this as a trial or not here is hard to judge, but it's certainly a very important hearing which will then lead to a condemnation at the morning trial in 15:1, just a few minutes apparently, although I suspect probably it is a trial. Well, the last incident then in our chapter, a narration of Peter's denials in verses 66 through 72. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, so we see the incident occurring upstairs in a building that has an open court in the middle of it, standard procedure in ancient Palestine, that's the kind of buildings they used. One of the servant girls, the high priest, came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You too were with Jesus the Nazarene." But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you're talking about." And he went out onto the porch. And the maid saw him and began once more to say to the bystanders. This is one of them. Again, he was denying it. And after a little while, the bystanders were again saying to Peter, "Surely you're one of them, for you're a Galilean too." and begin to curse and swear, "I do not know this man you're talking about." Immediately a cock crowed a second time, and Peter remembered how Jesus had made the remark to him, "Before a cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." And he began to weep. Well, this incident is one which Peter essentially set up on his own by following the crowd into the courtyard of the high priest. He may have done it in a purely innocent way. He may have forgotten all about the remarks about the betrayal, or he may have done it in a not very innocent way. He may have remembered those remarks, may have remembered the fact that Jesus said, "You're all going to flee away and be scattered," and he said, "Not me, Lord." Perhaps he was determined that he was not going to fall away, he was not going to be scattered, so he follows in. We don't know. Have to ask Peter to find out what his motivation was at that time. At minimum, in any case, I think we see Peter doing something that he's rushing into an area where his strength is not really great enough to carry him once things begin to happen. Whether he rushed into it with not very good motivations or not is hard to judge. He certainly had been warned by Jesus, in any case. So he had followed the mob all the way into the courtyard, and probably the gate was closed. So he was more or less locked in to the place with a guard standing around, some of whom doubtless had clubs and swords. We guess probably a substantial number, the 200 had been dismissed already, but still some standing around. And then while this trial is going on, and Mark groups these all together so he doesn't tell us how they're spread out through the trial, but we see a threefold denial that has been predicted by Jesus is fulfilled. One of the servant girls of the high priest comes up. She recognizes him. We don't know whether she recognizes him because she's the gatekeeper and saw him come in and such. She did see him come in, apparently. We learned that from the other Gospels. Or whether she recognized him because she now realizes she'd seen him with Jesus somewhere in his teaching situation somewhere. This would understand that she'd been out in one of the crowd somewhere at one time and had seen him and recognized him. In any case, she charges him, and he denies it. And then he tries to get away, goes out to the porch, forecourt something. We don't know exactly the structure of the building, exactly how that functions. And there, again, she sees him, starts talking to the bystanders. This is one of them, rather obvious public sort of thing. And again, he denies it. And then there's a pause for a while. And then the bystanders, apparently, are thinking over things about him and recognize he's got a Galilean accent. That's mentioned more explicitly in the other Gospels. And so they really begin to lean on him now, and so he has to curse and swear that by God he's not, and he doesn't know this guy at all, and things of that sort. Now, if you compare this with the other Gospels, we find some different details in the other three Gospels, Matthew, Luke, and John. There have been various suggestions for how to harmonize these together. I'm aware of two or three of them anyway. I'm not sure which one is actually the right one. The one I prefer, doesn't prove that's what happened, is that there were exactly three denials. There have been people who have had as many as six denials worked out, but since it says three in all four Gospels, it's, I think, most natural to assume there are exactly three. But several of them were in a crowd scene, and therefore there were several people talking to him. In other words, you have really three incidents. Somebody comes up and says, "Yes, you're with him," and somebody else says, "Yeah, he looks like it," or something like that. So you have several people say something to him, and he talks them off. And then he goes somewhere else, and he runs into the same girl again, and another girl, and she says something, and somebody else says something, and he tries to deny it again, talk them off. And then he goes away and maybe sits by himself, and he's not noticed for a while, but an hour or so later, then the thing comes up again, and they really press on him. How he gets out of the place, we don't really know. But apparently with all the oath or something, they either believe him or they're not worried about it or something. They let him go. He gets away, and he runs off and begins to weep. Right after the last denial, we have the crowing of the cock. The remark about two times, before the cock crows two times, you'll deny me twice, I think is best to be understood that the cock crowed twice right at one shot, rather than that they crowed once and it was a long period and crowed again. There's a textual question on that in the Greek here. Various manuscripts read differently, and I've looked them over. It's not anything you can make a decision beyond any question, but I think that's the most simple understanding. Otherwise, we'd have to understand that the other three Gospels just don't bother to mention an earlier cock crow, which would have been a warning of some sort then. They have, in trying to save space, have simplified the story slightly and don't deal with a preliminary cock crowing. I rather prefer the suggestion that the two crowings are right together after he has denied it three times, but I might be mistaken about that. Then Peter goes away and weeps bitterly, as the other Gospels say, and in apparently then an agony of remorse for several days until the Lord himself appears to him. Well, that's chapter 14 of Mark. We'll call Roman numeral 10, Jesus' death and resurrection, the last two chapters of Mark. And capital A, Jesus condemned and crucified. The first section under this is Jesus before Pilate, and consists of verses 1 through 5. Let me read that for you. And early in the morning, the chief priests, with the elders and scribes and the whole council, immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him up to Pilate. And Pilate questioned him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And answering, he said to him, "It is as you say." And the chief priests began to accuse him harshly. And Pilate was questioning him again, saying, "Do you make no answer? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Coming on from our last chapter, where we had seen the trial before the Sanhedrin, and then the incidents relating to the denials by Peter, which took place simultaneously, but Mark narrates them separately, we see that the Sanhedrin had brought charges against Jesus, had not been able to substantiate any of them, and finally had the high priest had himself stood up to make Jesus give his own statement of who he was and ask him if he were the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One, and Jesus answered he was, and the high priest took that as blasphemy and felt he had a charge which the whole Sanhedrin could agree on. Now, early in the morning, and we're not told what time exactly, but presumably it must be getting light or something of that sort, call it morning, the Sanhedrin meets again. Possibly they are meeting a second time to satisfy a requirement that we find in the Talmud now, in which a capital crime had to have the verdict brought twice at two separate sessions. They were supposed to be a day apart. We don't know for sure what the age of those particular requirements are, but there's certainly a possibility here that the Sanhedrin has tried to stay fairly close to bounds of certain rules of procedure it's got, but on the other hand, in their desire to get Jesus put away quickly, they're straining things. So it's hard to say for sure because the Talmud is so much later, but that's certainly a fair suggestion. They quickly hold a consultation then, but because the Jews do not have, during this period, the right to put people to death, they have to have this verified by Pilate. And so they bring him before Pilate, and we can see they bring him with the charge that he is claiming to be king of the Jews. Pilate would not care too much if Jesus claimed to be the Son of the Blessed One or something of that variety. So what basically the Jews do is they take that feature of the Messiahship that they think will most seem to be a threat to the Romans, namely the claim to be a companion king, and they attack Jesus by charging him with that. Interestingly enough, then, Pilate asks Jesus if he is king of the Jews, and Jesus says yes. And yet what's rather strange in the account is Pilate doesn't say, that's it, and put him away right there. And I think what we have here is something that Mark does not explain in detail, but which we see especially in John, to somewhat extent in Luke as well, that further talk between Pilate and Jesus makes it very clear to Pilate that the way Jesus is using the term king is not any threat to Caesar. And we see that spelled out in detail. So in spite of the fact that Jesus admits to that, Pilate finds really nothing wrong with him, but the members of the Sanhedrin who are there keep trying to heap charges upon him, and Pilate really is very surprised that Jesus does not respond to these, and obviously doesn't show himself fearful or anything. Obviously Pilate would not be amazed at that. But we see a picture here, I think, of Jesus, the charge having been made, Pilate, seeing that there's really nothing to the charge, does not mean anything like what the high priests are trying to make out of it. Jesus is not really going to participate anymore in answering further charges they bring up. You're really getting a situation, again, where the priests are trying to fish around for a charge they can stick Jesus with, just as they were trying to do in the Sanhedrin trial itself. And already I think we see Pilate somewhat concerned about the matter. Jesus is reacting in a strange way. Pilate is perhaps not quite as concerned about justice as he is about not having too much hassle. And we see that whole problem continues on through the trial here. The next subdivision we'll take here, verses 6 through 15, a different theme, still involved in Jesus before Pilate, but we'll make it a separate heading, is Barabbas released and Jesus condemned, verses 6 through 15. Let me read that passage for you. Now at feast, he used to release for them any one prisoner whom they requested. And a man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. And the multitude went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he was aware that the chief priests had delivered him up because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the multitude to ask him to release Barabbas for them instead. And answering again, Pilate was saying to them, "Then what shall I do with him whom you call the king of the Jews?" And they shouted back, "Crucify him." But Pilate was saying to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." And wishing to satisfy the multitude, Pilate released Barabbas for them, and after having Jesus scourged, he delivered him to be crucified. In this section again, we have more detail in the other Gospels, in Matthew, Luke, and John. It appears, however, that there was some sort of a custom that on the feast, that is on the Passover feast, the governor was in the habit of letting one prisoner go whom the crowd would request. Seems to have been something of some history here, although we don't have any other further information about it. So apparently while Pilate is trying to figure out how to get out of this mess, a crowd of people come running up who probably don't even know anything about Jesus, and they're trying to get somebody released. We don't know much about what the crowd was there for. Maybe there were a bunch of people who were favorable to Barabbas who were already looking to get him out. Maybe not. Who knows? But Pilate saw, he thought, a chance to get out of the situation. We see in verse 10 that he already recognizes that the problem is the chief priests don't really have anything against Jesus. They hate him. And they're trying to stick a charge on him that can't really go. And so Pilate gets the idea, perhaps, well, maybe the crowd will call for Jesus, and that will let him off the hook. The priest can't blame him if the people require this and he has to give up somebody for the thing anyway. But the priests obviously are already suspecting what's going on, and so they get among the crowd with their henchmen very quickly and begin to turn the crowd around in the direction of Barabbas. So Pilate, after not taking what would have been the right step in the first place, seeing that their charges amounted to nothing, just letting Jesus go and not worrying about the consequences, he now begins to compromise in various ways. And the ones to try and put it, get the crowd to bail him out, let the priest feed him to it, and the crowd won't bail him out. The crowd instead asks for Barabbas. And then he starts to argue with them, trying to get them to judge, but he's essentially already handed over the judgment to them. They're not going to argue with him. They're just going, "We want Barabbas. What shall I do with Jesus? Well, crucify him. What evil has he done? Crucify him," etc. When you start getting a mob going, there's not too much sense arguing with them, particularly if they've decided what they want to do. And that's basically what has happened here. Now, it looks as though in Mark that perhaps Pilate has already given in at this point, although if you compare the other Gospels, probably the mockery by the soldiers is intended to be one last play to see if he can get Jesus off without having him put to death. That's not seen quite so clearly in Mark, but seems to be the case from the parallel passages. Let me read that passage to you, the third section under chapter 15, Jesus mocked by the soldiers, verses 16 through 20. "And the soldiers took him away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and they called together the whole Roman cohort, and they dressed him up in purple, and after weaving the crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to acclaim him, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they kept beating his head with a reed and spitting at him and kneeling and bowing before him. And after they had mocked him, they took the purple off him and put his garments on him, and they led him out to crucify him." According to the Gospel of John, this mocking precedes the final decision to crucify Jesus. So probably Mark has put it here to avoid interrupting the Barabbas-Jesus sequence, as he has done also with the denial by Peter. He moves it, although it overlaps the Sanhedrin trial, rather than switching back and forth, this is a possible way of handling it, he moves one of them, discusses the one, and discusses the other. And I think that's what we have going here. We learn from Luke that already when Jesus had been sent to Herod and back, which Mark does not deal with, he's giving a brief account, that Herod himself and his soldiers had mocked Jesus and had thrown some kind of a fancy garment on him or something. So one may very well suggest here that probably Pilate got the idea for a mockery of this sort from what Herod had already done. And now he decides, maybe if he makes Jesus look silly enough, the crowd will see that there's really nothing to the charge, and they will be satisfied with him being beaten or something of that variety. These are all speculations on the motive there, but we see then that the soldiers are allowed to play around and mock Jesus then for a while, and pretending to bow to him, but grabbing the scepter out of his hand and beating him over the head with it, etc., and probably showing not only what they think of him, but what they think of the Jews at the same time. I think there's a moderate amount of anti-Semitism going on in both the Romans' reaction here and probably in Pilate's remark of putting up the King of the Jews instead of he said he was the King of the Jews or something of that variety. He's burned at the high priests, and he's going to try and get back at them in some way. Now, Mark's use of the incident, where he does not bring up anything about the motives and things of that variety, I think is basically he puts the incident in here so that we do not get the idea that it's the Jews that are doing all the mocking to Jesus. But the Gentiles were involved in this as well. The Jews were involved in injustice. They tried to get him on various charges, and not being able to make them stick, they then tried to get him on something else. And finally, when he says, "I am the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed," they don't investigate whether he is. They just say he's guilty. And then when they take him to the Romans, they try to switch the charge somewhat so we'll have some weight with the Romans. And when they can't get that, they just use political pressure to try and push it through. Well, on the other hand, Pilate shows injustice in that after deciding that Jesus is really not guilty, he allows the political pressure and fear for things that are going to happen to him and to his position and such, or riots and such, which would look very bad back in Rome, to sway him from doing what's right. Likewise, in the mockery, we have, first of all, the Sanhedrin and its assistants mocking Jesus after their trial. Now we have the Romans mocking Jesus after the Roman trial. And we see, likewise, the Herodians mocking Jesus in Herod's trial in the Gospel of Luke. But Mark's use of the incident here, then, I think, is basically to illustrate the fact that the Romans were involved in mistreating Jesus as well, that the Gentiles were mistreating Jesus as well. In anti-Semitic circles, it's very common to concentrate on the Jews' responsibility for the death of Jesus and ignore the Gentiles' responsibility for the death of Jesus. Both of them are very clear in the scriptures, and I think this is an example of it right here. Number four, then, is Jesus crucified, verses 21 to 32. They took the purple off him, put his garments on him, and led him out to be crucified, verse 20. And they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. They tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him, and divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And they crucified two robbers with him, one on his right, one on his left. The scripture was fulfilled, which says, "And he was numbered with transgressors." And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "Ha, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." And in the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes, were mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross, so that we may see and believe." And those who were crucified with him were casting the same insult at him. We see Jesus then is led out to be crucified, and Mark is moving through this rather rapidly, so he doesn't give you all the details about Jesus carrying his cross some distance, and then apparently breaking down from the mistreatment that he's had, and Simon being pressed to carry this out. The remark here, which occurs only in Mark, the father of Alexander and Rufus, suggests that some of the immediate readers of Mark were apparently familiar with these two people. It's been speculated that Mark, on the basis of tradition, was originally written in Rome, and that these were two people living in Rome who were sons of this Simon of Cyrene mentioned here, and so known to the readers. Well, in any case, he is taken out, and the cross carried by them. Then we have various details relating to the crucifixion. The mention of the term Golgotha. Golgotha is a word for skull, and some commentators suggested that was because it was a flat space with a lot of skulls laying around. That is pretty unlikely, because the Jews would not leave bodies unburied if they could avoid it. So I think it's much more likely that, as the tradition suggests, it's a little hill, that there's something that reminds you of the skull about that hill. The so-called Gordon's Calvary over in Jerusalem today has somewhat of a skull appearance. It's a limestone rock that's worn away to look a little bit like a skull. And the tradition is that the site on which the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is built was likewise built on a hill, which, however, had been badly modified after the time of Christ by one of the Roman emperors who built the Temple to Venus over the traditional site of Jesus' death and burial. So I think the suggestion that it is a little hill shaped like a skull is probably the best guess on the use of the term Golgotha. Jesus refuses the wine with myrrh here. This is apparently a drug of some sort to kill pain. And whether it was given for humanitarian reasons or whether this was given just so that the Romans would not have much hassle in putting the person on the cross, we don't know. Jesus refuses to take it, we don't know his motives, okay. It may be that in suffering on the cross, part of it is bearing the pain involved in it. And part of the problem may be his wanting to remain clear in his mind to be able to speak and to respond and things of that variety. We're not told, but he refuses to take this drugged wine. Then we're told of the Roman soldiers here casting lots. There are a number of different ways in which lots were cast in antiquity, though the usual guess here is a different stone for each person involved in a lot is put in helmet and shook, and the first stone that pops out is the winner, something of that variety. That's a common method of casting lots in antiquity, though we also have little dice from antiquity, ivory with spots on them, very much like our dice look. So difficult to judge for sure just which technique is being used here. We're told the time in which he was crucified is the third hour, and that on the Jewish measuring system would be the third hour since dawn, the 9 a.m. roughly, and that they begin to crucify him then, and then the period of darkness later, we'll see, is also time given on that. The inscription is given for us here. If you notice in the four Gospels, the inscription is worded slightly differently here and there. Whether that means that we're not getting the exact inscription or whether one of the writers is giving us a translation of the Latin, one is giving us a translation of the Greek, and one of the Aramaic, we don't know. The Gospel writers in general are giving us an abbreviated account, and so one or more of them may have abbreviated the inscription it occurs. All of them make the point that the charge reads, "the King of the Jews," rather than "he claimed to be," or something like that, and that the priests are not very happy about this matter. The two robbers are also mentioned here, but Mark, in giving a compressed account, does not deal with the fact that one of them repents later, as we see in Luke. Again, we see mockery, however. The passers-by, some of them not favorable to Jesus, knowing something about his claims, knowing some of the miracles he had done, things of that variety, are mocking him regarding the claim, which they had heard about, that he was going to destroy the temple and build it up, and saying, well, you know, if you could really do something like that, you could certainly come down from the cross. There's a certain irony in this mockery that I think they do not understand, and that is that his remark about destroying the temple is exactly what they're doing right now, and he will build it up in 3 days. But he has to die first, and let this Messiah, the King of Israel, come down from the cross so that we may see and believe would, of course, have been the greatest disaster in the world had Christ actually done that, had he ceased in his dying for sinners in order to satisfy the problems that these men had. We see the chief priests and the scribes actually out here mocking him, which many people have found very hard to believe. But I think the reason they found that hard to believe is they don't believe Jesus was who he claimed to be, and they therefore don't believe that Jesus was such a problem for the chief priests and the scribes as he was. They saw someone that they did not know any way to get rid of, and they couldn't answer an argument and things like that, and suddenly, almost beyond their hopes, things do work out. They've got him on the cross now and such. So they feel, I think, justified that their belief that his working is really of Satan must be true, and they're now coming down to make the most of it. So we see more mockery. We then have Jesus' actual death narrated for us in verses 33 through 41. Jesus dies. And when the sixth hour had come, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And when some of the bystanders heard it, they began saying, behold, he is calling for Elijah. And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave him a drink, saying, let us see whether Elijah will come and take him down. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. When the centurion, who was standing right in front of him, saw the way he breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. And there were also some women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James the Less and Joses and Salome. And when he was in Galilee, they used to follow him and minister to him. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. So this is a section on the death of Jesus. We're told about this darkness for 3 hours, from 6th to the 9th hour, that is from noon to 3 p.m. Obviously, it's not an eclipse of the sun. First place, eclipses of the sun don't occur near the full moon, since the moon's on the wrong side of the earth to get an eclipse. Secondly, no eclipses last 3 hours. So in the technical sense of the term, eclipse meaning the moon passing in front of the sun, it's obviously not an eclipse of the sun. No one has given us a detailed description of it, so we don't know whether it was a very unusual darkening produced by heavy clouds or whether it was something totally unrelated, something that a person at that time with no scientific information couldn't even have guessed what the thing was. Did the actual light from the sun stop? Did something come between the sun and the earth and block it? We have no idea. We're just told what happened. We're not told how it was caused. It's pretty obviously rather striking. And that's seen in a couple of the other accounts. We have Jesus' words from the cross here. There are 7 statements that he makes from the cross at various times, but only one of those is directly recorded in Mark, and the other one is mentioned, though it doesn't tell you what he said. The one here that does tell us what he said, which is recorded in the Gospels in general, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, the reason it's given, I think, in the Aramaic is because there's a confusion by the hearers of what the first couple words mean. They think he's calling to Elijah, which sounds somewhat similar. And I've heard people say, any Hebrew could tell the difference between Eloi and Elias. But, when somebody's shouting at some distance in a way and you weren't paying attention when they started and he's probably not in very good physical shape anyway, it's easy to confuse something. The point the writer is making, I think, in giving us the exact words is to see how the confusion occurred. They apparently think that since Elijah is supposed to be the forerunner of the Messiah, that Jesus is calling upon Elijah to come bail him out or something of that variety. And apparently, at least some of them mock at that in the idea, well, he's going to find out now that he's not really the Messiah, since Elijah hasn't come to bail him out. The one who runs with a sponge, it's hard to figure out his motivation exactly. Perhaps the idea that he really thinks it's a possibility it might happen, or something of that sort. But we still see some mockery, I think, at this point. Then we have Jesus utters a loud cry and breathed his last, verse 37, probably referring to what elsewhere we're told is, it is finished, is probably his last cry. The providing of the sponge with this vinegar on it, or sour wine, probably allows Jesus to moisten his mouth so that he can speak. And so he shouts out this loud last cry, which I would guess is the it is finished, and then breathes his last, as Mark says, others gave up the spirit and such, and he dies at that point. Then we have the response of God on the one hand and the response of the centurion on the other hand. At this very moment, the large curtain that separates the Holy of Holies, the innermost part of the temple, from the holy place is ripped open, and the ripping occurs from the top downward. We're not told anything about whether God used any means to do this or whether he did it directly, but we have no word of anything like this having happened before. And the time of day at which this occurs, there probably would have been priests in the holy place, so would have been rather struck by what was going on and would have known about this. The tearing open, I think, has rather obvious significance, that the barrier between man and God's presence, where even the high priest could only come once a year into the Holy of Holies, and only that with a blood to sprinkle and such, is now changed. And we see the writer of Hebrews comments on that general picture, though he doesn't explicitly remark the matter of this ripping of the curtain. I think we see a symbolic action there, and then another with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, in which God points out that he is finished with this situation of access to God by means of the sacrifices and such. And there the way into God's presence is through the death of Jesus Christ. The response of the centurion, who we don't have any particular reason to believe was inclined towards Christianity or anything of that sort at any earlier period, though we really don't know anything about him. He has seen the mockery and how Jesus responds to that. He has seen how Jesus has conducted himself. He has seen the darkness. He has presumably seen what happened to the other thief on the cross, presuming he was near enough. And he has seen the other phenomena related to the death of Christ. And he then says, truly this man was the Son of God. And what the centurion's theology at this point is not easy to answer, whether he says a son of the gods or the Son of God, though I think we're inclined to feel that God is working in the heart of this fellow. And if his theology is not fantastic at the point at which the event occurs, it will improve eventually. So just on enough about the guy. The Greek could be translated either way, a son of God or the Son of God. But the response to the centurion is very positive and indicates that something very, very striking has happened. We're also told, in connection with the death of Jesus, that the women are standing at a distance and watching what is going on. And that's rather significant, as we'll see that theme is carried on through the rest of this chapter and into the next chapter as well. These women are at a distance from the cross, so it's possible that John and Jesus' mother wanted to get closer or something of that variety. It's possible the whole group was closer at one point and moves back at another point. The soldiers may not have been the greatest company in the world, but hard to tell. We're not given much information in that direction. The picture we get, however, I think, is that except for John, none of the men disciples venture anywhere near the place. Apparently a large number of the women do. We're even told here that it's not just the few that are named. The last section in this chapter is the burial of Jesus. Jesus buried, verses 42 through 47. And when evening had already come, because it was the preparation day, that is the day before the Sabbath, Joseph Arimathea came, prominent member of the council, who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God. And he gathered up courage and went in before Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time, and summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining this from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. And Joseph brought a linen cloth, took him down, wrapped him in the linen cloth, laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of a rock, and he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, were looking on to see where he was laid. It's a rather interesting picture of the providence of God that although Jesus would have been expected at this point to have been buried with criminals, to have been thrown in a common grave of some sort, as doubtless the other two criminals were, and his followers appear to have been too scared to make an attempt to do anything. The apostles are off hiding out somewhere, apparently. There are a few women standing at a distance. One person who has been impressed by Jesus and who is secretly a believer but has not made any profession of this before this time, a member of the Sanhedrin, whether a prominent member of the Sanhedrin is the proper translation, or a prominent man, a member of the Sanhedrin, hard to say. But in any case, a member of the Sanhedrin, now it says, gathered up courage. And so the Lord gave him the courage at this point to come forward and approach Pilate, because certainly this is not going to help his further reputation or anything. And presumably from what he knows at this point, it's too late to join Jesus' side or something, so to speak. But he certainly knew what had gone on in the Sanhedrin, whether he was there or not. I expect he was there. There's nothing said about unanimous vote or anything. He had known what had gone on. He knew what the injustice was. He knew what Jesus' ministry was. And in spite of not realizing anything about Jesus' resurrection, he was willing at this point to come forward and at least give Jesus a decent burial. This is a very striking fulfillment of a prophecy in Isaiah, where it says in Isaiah 53, they determined his grave to be with the wicked, and yet he was with a rich man in his death, be a fairly accurate translation of the Hebrew there. That is, the plan would be that he would make his grave with wicked men, but in fact, he was with a rich man in his death. And that was due to the intervention of Joseph Arimathea here. And Pilate is not about to hand the body over to somebody until he's sure it's a body. And so he checks with the centurion to make sure Jesus is really dead. It's surprised that he's dead so quickly. Death by crucifixion would normally take a long time. I think we're to understand partially the very great physical trials Jesus had gone through. We're also told elsewhere Jesus gave up his spirit, but whether he did that while he was still in great shape or not, I don't think we're to understand that. So Jesus has died, and that's the reason, as we see in the other accounts, that his legs are not broken. They had to have them dead before the Sabbath started because they would really offend the Jews to have them on the cross that late. They break the legs of the other ones because then they can't hold themselves up, and they will die of strangulation from not being able to breathe very quickly. But Jesus is already dead. They don't do that. And thereby fulfilling the remark about not a bone would be broken. But a Pilate checks to make sure that he's dead before releasing the body. And then Joseph Arimathea, and presumably with some helpers, takes Jesus down and takes him rather quickly nearby to his own tomb. It is a rather classy tomb, though there's not any big point made of it here. But the remark about a tomb hewn out of the rock itself suggests that it's a rather nice tomb. And then with the remark of a stone rolled against it, makes a rather expensive type of tomb as well. We learn elsewhere that it's Joseph's own private tomb, and it had never been used before. And again, we see the women watching to note the location of his burial. Well, that's chapter 15, Jesus condemned and crucified. And chapter 16, then, is Jesus triumphant. We'll call the first section his resurrection. Verses 1 through 8. Let me read that for you. And when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome bought spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. And they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, although it was extremely large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting at the right wearing a white robe. And they were amazed. And he said to them, "Do not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who has been crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold, here is the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter. He is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he said to you." And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had gripped them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The first remark here, when the Sabbath was over, they bought spices, etc., points out something that we might not think of at first. The Jewish days, at least the days of the week, Sabbath, etc., start at sunset and run to the next sunset, rather than starting at midnight, as ours do. And so, sunset, Saturday evening, the Sabbath is over, the shops will be open for a few hours in the evening, and so the women go out to purchase spices that they want to help anoint the body of Jesus with, but are not about to go around in a tomb in the middle of the night. So they gather the stuff together and get ready to go out the next morning. And then we're told that indeed they arrive at the tomb when the sun has just risen. So it's light, fully light with the sun up as they reach the tomb. On the way to the tomb, apparently, a problem suddenly occurs to them that they appear not to have thought about. And that is that this big stone had been rolled over the door of the tomb. There are a number of tombs still existing in Palestine today with these rolling stone, sort of a big disc that is used to keep animals out of the tomb. And we're told this one was extremely large, so apparently the several women do not think that they're going to have the strength to get it moved and are wondering what they're going to do. But they hadn't thought of it earlier to get some apostles or somebody to come with them, so here they are. And while they're worried about it, they come up to the side of the tomb, and there's the tomb already open. They go inside here. And I would understand, comparing this with the other gospel accounts, that Mary Magdalene does not go inside. As soon as she sees something wrong, she immediately heads off to let the disciples that she can find know something has arrived. So although she comes to the tomb, it does not appear that she stays. The other women go on in. That's a fairly characteristic feature throughout the gospels, that they're very compressed accounts, and the writer is getting across certain points, and he's not trying to elaborate all the details. And a different gospel writer is making other points, and so dealing with other features. Mark has made a selection of certain features about the resurrection he's going to deal with, and he deals with those, and he doesn't deal with how they fit together with other things. So we're left with a question of how to fit them together, and I think that's probably what we see going on here. The others apparently enter the tomb. We see that Mary Magdalene, when she comes back, doesn't know that there's anything about an angel, doesn't know where he's gone, anything of that sort. So the other women enter the tomb, and they see a young man sitting at the right wearing a white robe. We learn from other accounts that this is not just a young man who happens to be out for an early morning stroll or the gardener or anything of that sort. This is an angel. The term young man and angel are fairly frequently interchanged in appearances in Scripture, both Old and New Testament. And apparently that is the way angels appear to men. And I will not climb out on a limb on whether that's what they really look like or not. But that's the way they regularly appear to men. Angels appear in a human form, and they apparently do not appear. You can guess, I suppose, why they don't appear as decrepit. They're not subject to death. It may very well be that a being who is not subject to death looks like a young person. Whether they all look like men or not, I don't know, but the ones we have particularly mentioned do. The pictures of little babies with wings on them, cherubim and such, seen in medieval paintings and Renaissance paintings, as far as I know, have no biblical support of any kind. So we'll not get into that. However, he gives them a message. First of all, he knows who they're looking for. You're looking for Jesus, the Nazarene. And he points out that he's risen, that is, he's not dead, but he's not here, not present in the tomb at the moment. And he points out the place where Jesus was. We would guess from John's account that probably this grave clothes are still lying there where they lay before. At least that's the case by the time Peter and John get there. No reason to assume they've wandered around anywhere in between. So he points the place. And then he gives them a message. He says, go tell his disciples and Peter, mentions Peter, probably for his encouragement, that he hasn't been forgotten or he isn't left out in spite of what he has done in denying Jesus. He is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he said to you. So this message that he's risen, that he's going to go to Galilee ahead of them, and that they will see him there. Then we're told the women run out of the place. They're afraid. The trembling and astonishment might not be fear of anybody in the sense of fear of the soldiers or anything of that variety, but I think just overcome with the magnitude of what has happened. And we regularly see in Scripture a fear that grips someone when they come in contact with supernatural, and particularly in contact with the angelic or theophanies, things of that sort. I think that's it. And it says they said nothing to anyone for they were afraid. That statement is obviously not absolute. I mean, after all, Mark knows about it from somewhere, so they must have said something to somebody sometime. I think basically what it does mean is they did not go advertising it as they ran up the road, but they went to look for the disciples, and they did not talk to anybody until they found the disciples. Well, that's Mark 16, 1 through 8. Now we come to a question regarding the last 12 verses of the Gospel of Mark, verses 9 through 20, and that is a question of the authenticity of this particular passage. There are only two passages of more than a couple verses that I know of in the New Testament that there's any question about their authenticity, and that would be this passage, Mark 16, 9 through 20, and the incident of the adulterous woman in John 7:53 and 8:11. There are a number of passages down around a one or two verse length, and then virtually everything else where there are questions or questions of a word or two here and there, things of that sort. The trick with this particular passage is, although it's only a few of the witnesses to the text that don't have it, that is out of 5,000 or so witnesses in the Greek language, and 8,000 in the Latin and stuff. There's only a few of the manuscripts that don't have it, but these are a few of the most important witnesses, a few of the earliest witnesses, which tend to be most reliable. We're not going to get into a long discussion of text criticism here. There have been three possibilities that have been suggested regarding the text. One is, yes, the text is authentic. 16, 9 through 20 is authentic. But an early manuscript of the Gospel of Mark lost its last page or something of that variety. And so there was a group of rather important manuscripts that copied from that that did not have the end of the Gospel of Mark. A second suggestion would be no, the last 12 verses are not authentic, but that Mark ended so abruptly at verse 8 that it was felt that it was too abrupt and a ending was either composed or borrowed from some other work, perhaps one of the accounts that Luke mentions. Several people have drawn up an account and was added to the gospel to supply an ending. The third one is more speculative than either of these, and that is that Mark originally had another ending than what it's got now, that ending was lost on virtually the first copy that was made, and that some manuscripts, therefore, went without an ending, and for others, an ending was composed. I think that's the most speculative. It has only one thing, perhaps, in its favor. It has no manuscript evidence in its favor, because it's a lost ending, okay, by definition. The only thing it's got in its favor is perhaps the peculiar way in which the sentence ends. If you imagine that the thing was authentic, but it was lost in some copies, then you've got to say, well, for some reason, the page it was lost was exactly at the end of a sentence, which, of course, possible, but rather unlikely. And sentences rather rarely end the way this particular sentence does in Greek. So there are a number of people who have favored this. I'm reluctant to climb anything like out on that thin a limb, though I don't think it's impossible that something like that could have happened. I think we have an example in the Old Testament at one spot where a piece of information that was originally in the text is lost regarding how old Saul was when he came to the throne and how long he reigned. Can't give you right offhand now the verses of that passage. But I'm reluctant to go that direction. So I think it comes down between these two, the idea that it was original and got lost early, lost in some manuscripts, or that it was not original, but someone added the thing. I would say I am still up in the air myself on the matter. I don't think it's quite as open and shut a case as it is frequently made, either on the one side of people who follow the King James only and are not willing to look at manuscripts that are based on any other kind of text, nor on the other side of people who take the manuscripts, these particular early witnesses I'm suggesting, and follow them in almost all directions. We're going to operate here on the basis that it is in the text, that is, it's worth discussing and dealing with, though, as a matter of fact, I don't know for sure. And we will deal with the rest of the material as though it is a part of the Gospel of Mark. I might point out that while almost everything in the rest of the Gospel of Mark is parallel to a certain extent in the other Gospels, none of it is exactly like the rest of the Gospels. And so you wonder if somebody invented this rest of the material just by copying from the Gospels, why they did some strange things they did. If, of course, they got it from early oral tradition, then it's still a valuable source of information, even if it's not in the original text. It's certainly possible, though. It's something that was originally there, and that the loss of a page in an early manuscript has made more trouble than it really ought. Well, without going into that further, let's look at the next. The appearance to Mary Magdalene, verses 9 through 11. Now, after he had risen early on the first day of the week, he first appeared to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out 7 demons. She went and reported to those who had been with him while they were mourning and weeping. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they refused to believe it. This is the first of these incidents in the last 12 verses of Mark. It's parallel to John 20, verses 11 through 18, where we have Mary Magdalene seeing Jesus and going and such. But if you read the two passages over, it's quite clear that Mark does not depend upon the other passage. The other passage has Mary going to Peter and John, at which point she has not seen Jesus, and tells them the tomb is empty. And we don't get anything about their response except they go look. And when they go look, they say, lo and behold, the tomb is empty. And then they go off, and by that time Mary has got by the tomb. She looks in the tomb. Then Jesus appears to her. So his appearance to her is after she's going to get those. And then we're told nothing else about what Mary does or what the response is. Here the whole emphasis is on the other end. After Mary has seen him, what does she do? She goes and finds some believers. They're weeping. They're very concerned about Jesus' death and probably have not heard anything about the stories of his resurrection yet, and they don't believe her. So we have a picture of unbelief in general on her report. So the accounts are really rather different and don't really suggest that this account, verses 9 through 11, was written by looking at John and writing up an account. It's just got very different information, but they're consistent, as far as we can tell. Then the third section here, the second section in the last 12 verses, the third in chapter 16, would be the appearance to two disciples, verses 12 and 13. After that, he appeared in different form to two of them while they were walking along on their way to the country. And they went away and reported to the others, but they did not believe them either. Presumably, this is an account of the appearance of Jesus to the two on the road to Emmaus. I wouldn't be too dogmatic about that, but that's presumably what it is. If that's so, again, it does not seem to depend upon that account in Luke chapter 24 of the two on the road to Emmaus. Why not? The Luke account mentions their eyes are held so they don't recognize Jesus, looking at God's activity in respect to the eyes of the person in some sense, whereas this says he appeared to them in another form, which almost kind of looks at it out from the other end of the thing and says he appeared in another form. And then there's a rather puzzling feature about this. It says of these that went back, the people have heard them refuse to believe it. Now that's rather difficult to know how to fit that with Luke if this is the appearance of two on the road to Emmaus, because there it appears, again we're getting a compressing of the events, that when they get back and tell them about this, the people already say, yeah, he has risen because he appeared to Peter. So I'm a little bit in a quandary whether this is the appearance to the two on the road to Emmaus. If it is, then we're looking at an earlier period where they get back and the people don't believe it, and then somebody comes in from Peter, or Peter comes in or something and says, yes, it's true, I've seen him too, or something like that. In other words, there's some period of time in which this is going on. The other alternative is this appearance to two other disciples. After all, there are plenty of disciples around, and a lot of them probably were going around two by two, another three by four, and things of that variety. And we may have another appearance mentioned here, and the ones that they went back to didn't believe it either. So I would leave it somewhat up in the air on whether this is the appearance of the two on the road to Emmaus. Then we have a section of five verses, the disciples commissioned, verses 14 through 18. And afterwards, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at the table. And he reproached them for their unbelief and hardness of heart because they had not believed those who had seen him after he had risen. And he said to them, go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. He who has believed and has been baptized shall be saved, but he who has disbelieved shall be condemned. And these signs shall accompany those who have believed. In my name they will cast out demons, they will speak with new tongues, they will pick up serpents, and if they drink any deadly poison, it shall not hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. Okay, what have we got here? Well, probably we have got a summary of a number of events that intervene between Jesus' resurrection and the ascension, rather than one incident at this point. The remark about appearing to the 11 and upbraiding them for their unbelief sounds rather like the appearance in the upper room the evening of the resurrection, though it may be combined with the appearance the next week as well. He appeared to the 11 while they were reclining at meal, and we understand Thomas was not there, so the 11 would either mean Matthias happened to be along with the others, and so 11 of the final 12 are there, or that this is in fact combining a couple of events a week or so apart. The first event, which we have for us in Luke and John, doesn't really say too much about reproach for their unbelief, although there's a little bit about it, but certainly there's a good bit reproaching Thomas for his unbelief in the thing a week later. So I'm inclined to suggest that we're looking at an upper room appearance at dinner in Jerusalem as the first of these two incidents in verses 14 through 18, with an emphasis on rebuke for unbelief. Notice the theme through this section. Mary Magdalene tells others, weeping, that Jesus appeared to her, they don't believe. Jesus appears to new disciples in a different form. When they recognize him and tell the others, they don't believe. And so now Jesus rebukes the disciples for their unbelief. So that theme is being carried through this particular section. The last few verses here, verses 15, 16, 17, 18 of this section, represents probably the commission scene on the mountain in Galilee that is narrated for us in more detail in Matthew 28, 16 through 20, though again, possibly we have a summary of Jesus' teaching during the whole 40 days. We have something of that sort in the end of Luke, which ends rather with it apparently runs all the way to the ascension in just a few verses without making any point. Well, a few days later he said this, and a few days later he said that, and things of this sort. Well, I think probably we're getting that same sort of summarization here. We're given the commission in verses 15 and 16, and this is very similar to the Great Commission given in Matthew 28:19-20. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. He who has believed and been baptized shall be saved, but he who has disbelieved shall be condemned. Then we have a section that we don't have an explicit reference to anywhere in the ministry of Jesus between the resurrection and ascension and the other gospels, but that's no big deal. He obviously must have had a number of things to say to them over 40 days. A sequence of signs that would follow the believers in Jesus. This is no guarantee that these signs are going to run through all ages, but if you want to do any of these things, go ahead and try, and if God protects you in it, great. The fact that it will follow them does not mean everybody's necessarily got it at every point. The signs given, the remark about the casting out demons, the remark about tongues, both in verse 17, and the remark about healing the sick in verse 18, are obviously things that we do see follow the disciples. That is, the apostles go out casting out demons, healing, and speaking in tongues, as we see in the book of Acts. The remark about the serpents, we see one example of in Acts, and it may well have occurred on other occasions, but we have one example, and that's the one found in Acts 28, verses 3 through 5. Paul is not a snake handler, but while he is in the course of his activities, a snake bites him and is used apparently by God in that circumstance to make an inroad for the gospel on the island of Malta, where he is bit by the snake. The people at first assume, aha, here is a criminal being brought to Rome, and even though the shipwreck has occurred where he should have died in a shipwreck as a judgment for his crimes, he has escaped that, but justice won't allow him to escape. The snake comes out and gets him, but then after a few hours, when the poison doesn't do anything to Paul, they decide, well, there must be something more to it than this, and it opens up an opportunity for the gospel in Malta in the following months. The remark about the poison, we have no biblical statements regarding anything of this sort happening. However, we do have a very early tradition from the church father Papias, living about 130 and probably being alive before the end of the first century. We are told at second hand that he has an account in his work, which no longer exists, or at least we don't know where it is if it does, that one of the two fellows who was put up for election as apostle in the beginning of Acts, it was Matthias and Justus Barsabbas, that the Barsabbas fellow was, in fact, forced to drink poison at one point and survived it. And that's mentioned then in Eusebius Church History, Book 3, Section 39, where he mentions offhand that this incident is narrated by Papias in his exposition of the Oracles of the Lord, written around 130 AD. We also have a rather wilder tradition in an apocryphal book called The Acts of John, where instead of somebody being forced to drink a poison, John, to demonstrate the power of the gospel, accepts somebody's challenge to drink a poison. In other words, under no obligation to do it or anything of that variety. He makes a big, you know, God's going to deliver me if I do this. They bring out two condemned criminals. They pour the poison down them. They both fall flat and die on the spot. And then John drinks the stuff and he's okay. I'm rather skeptical about the historicity of that particular event, since it's a little too much of the stage type magic, which you do not see in the biblical material, though it's conceivable that it is an elaboration of some incident that actually occurred. I wouldn't have any great problem with that, but we don't know. So I'll let that ride. But the particular signs given here are not in themselves anything that would be impossible for God to do. The last two verses then give us a quick summary of the ascension in the Gospel of Mark, and let's read those for you. Verses 19 and 20. So then, when the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was received up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God, and they went out and preached everywhere, while the Lord worked with them and confirmed the word by the signs that followed. We have here a parallel to one verse in Luke where there's a reference to the ascension, and then, of course, the material of the first few verses of Acts where we have the ascension. But like the end of the Gospel of Luke, I think we're getting a very quick summary here of the ascension, and then a quick summary of the activity of the apostles, just given in a sentence or so. They went out, and the Lord worked through them with them in giving these signs that indeed Christ had risen, and that these were his appointed men to go out and spread the gospel. I have no real problem of of saying that these last 12 verses could not be a part of the Gospel of Mark. It finishes off rather nicely. There's some stylistic questions which I've not had an opportunity to investigate thoroughly myself, and so I don't want to climb out on a limb in that particular direction. The Bible is quite clear that Jesus did appear to his followers afterwards, and whether these particular incidents here were in the original Mark would not be a concern in that particular direction. We see, however, in the Gospel of Mark, then, a brief, action-packed presentation of the ministry of Jesus. One of its themes, I think, is, who is this Jesus? And Mark leads you step by step through the activities and claims of Jesus until you see that indeed he is the Messiah, the Son of God, as Mark points out at the beginning of his gospel. Well, that basically is our tour of the Gospel of Mark, obviously rather fast with the time available, but I hope it will give you a little more appreciation of how he has presented the ministry of Jesus.
Biblical Theological Seminary is happy to have brought you this study in God's Word. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.